Case number 09-3087 et al. United States of America v. Lonnell Glover, appellant. Mr. Becker for appellant Wright, Mr. Curlin for appellant Glover, and Mr. Godez for the appellee.
Judge Brown, members of the panel, good morning. I'm Robert Becker, and I represent Mr. Wright in this appeal. We are here today because the government went to the wrong court to get a warrant to wiretap Mr. Glover's truck by installing a bug in it. Not because the court couldn't issue the wiretap warrant, but because it couldn't issue the warrant to install the device in Mr. Glover's truck, which for all purposes relevant to this case was in Maryland at all times and outside the jurisdiction of Judge Collier. This is not a situation where the government merely applied for a warrant and the judge issued one and they relied on it even though it was error for the issuance to happen. This is a case where a U.S. attorney, an assistant U.S. attorney, assisted the government in preparing the warrant, and this is a case where the attorney general or a designated assistant had to approve the application before it got to Judge Collier. And that person should be schooled in the requirements of Title III.
The installation of the device is not unauthorized. It's the use under the statute.
Judge Edwards, we are challenging the installation of this device.
Well, you may be, but that's the question I'm raising. I don't read the statute that way. You can show me. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
At least the Fourth Amendment requires that the warrant be valid and that it be issued in the jurisdiction where the truck was, even if the truck were going to move. The judge had to have jurisdiction over it at the time she issued the warrant, and this truck was not in D.C. It was at BWI Airport the entire time. And therefore, the entry into the truck violated the Fourth Amendment. Under Title III, the wiretap had to be suppressed because it was obtained in contrary to law under 2518.10.
And which law?
Under 2518.10.
You think under the statute? I don't think the statute prohibits the installation, prohibits use.
But the statute 2518.3 and Rule 41 require that the vehicle be in the jurisdiction when the judge issues the warrant.
Isn't it Rule 41 that you primarily rely on?
Well, I'm relying on Rule 41 for the fact and the word and 2518.3 for the proposition that the judge had to have jurisdiction over the truck at the time she issued the warrant, even if it subsequently moved out of the jurisdiction. But once she issued the warrant, they could not install the bug based on that warrant because she didn't have jurisdiction over the truck, which causes a Fourth Amendment violation at the moment they enter the truck. This is the clearest illustration of this would be a situation where a person is arrested without probable cause. A search 10 minutes later produces marijuana in the suspect's pocket. That doesn't cure the Fourth Amendment violation. Here, the truck was outside the jurisdiction. They didn't have a valid warrant to install the device. And the government's argument is a bootstrap. It tries to say that if the listening post was in D.C., then it didn't matter because the judge could issue the warrant. And as far as Title III is concerned, if no intrusion into the truck had been required, that would have been okay. The problem is the installation had to take place somewhere because it required the device that they put in the truck. And therefore, the warrant didn't, the communication that ended in a reception in D.C. did not happen until a day later, at the earliest, when Mr. Glover returned from Chicago. And so they can't bootstrap their jurisdiction to install the bug based on the communication because the communication was way subsequent to the installation.
Is there some data that you've specified that has caused your client some prejudice? Assuming that your argument is correct so far, that is, you can't install it and you can't use it, what is the specific use that has caused prejudice to your client?
The agent testified and transcripts were shown to the jury of conversation, at least one conversation Mr. Wright and Mr. Glover had in the truck, to the extent that most of the testimony against Mr. Wright and largely Mr. Glover came from a cooperating co-defendant who pled guilty and was suspect. There were no drugs ever seized. There was no money ever directly connected to the defendants in this case. And therefore, the communication, the discussion that happened in the truck is very damaging to the defense because it is a major part of the government's case, and you can see that from its opening argument and its closing, that they really wanted to focus the jury on that, those communications in the truck, as validation of their theory of the case.
My understanding of your argument on the Rule 41 is you're focusing on double I rather than single I. The order of authorization or approval under which it was intercepted is insufficient on its face.
I would say it's both.
You told me when you started out by saying unlawfully intercepted, was that single I?
That's single I, and that is the Fourth Amendment violation.
I know, but isn't your key with a double I?
I think it, Judge Silverman, I think
because
it's both.
Because the unlawful single I gets into a balancing test of core notions of...
Except that... Well, I think in Giordano, the court said that single I encompass both the constitutional issues and statutory issues.
I understand, but that's when you get into the core notion and the balancing test. But if you're relying on double I, it's insufficient on its face. It doesn't matter. You don't get into the balancing at all.
That's true, Judge Silverman, but then I would bring you to Jones, in which the issue was a judge had issued an order to install a device
now,
within...
Counsel, I don't think my question was hostile.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. The court said the court was confronted with a warrant that had been issued to install a device within 10 days in the district in compliance with 3117. And the device was installed 11 days later outside the district. And the court did not find those minor deviations to have been acceptable. It said, we don't countenance even that kind of error. So, and that's a Fourth Amendment violation. And so, in this case...
Well, the Giordano case is the one where the executive assistant to the Attorney General had authorized the order of death rather than the Assistant Attorney General.
Yes, that's
and
correct.
That's bango. That's insufficient on its face.
Yes, well, but that was clearly contrary to Title III.
Right. What makes it insufficient on its face?
Yes, and I would argue that this is falls under both of those provisions.
I thought it was sort of amusing that the opinion is written by an ex-deputy attorney general coming out that he wouldn't have had authority to sign the warrant.
Correct.
Or authorize the warrant.
But you know, I think the contrast between that and Chavez, where a designated assistant signed the application, but in fact the Attorney General had been the one who approved it, the court said that doesn't matter because a person covered by the statute approved the warrant, even though it criticized the government for making the error. This is not such a case as Chavez. This is a case where there was clearly a defect that caused the Fourth Amendment violation.
Mr. Becker, is the truck bug a mobile interception device?
It was apparently a cell phone that was installed in the truck and connected to the electrical system of the truck, according to the government. So.
No, but the judge is asking whether this falls within the mobile intercepted device referred to in the rule.
Well, it is in the sense that the judge could issue the warrant under Title III to include interceptions once the vehicle moved outside the jurisdiction. So, yes, for the purposes of the interception, the warrant could include that. The problem was the warrant could not authorize the installation of the device. If I may, for just one moment, call your attention to the speedy trial issue, which is that in this case, the court, Judge Hogan, found that there was presumptive prejudice to Mr. Wright in this case after 11 months and no trial date had been set. Now, I know, Judge Brown, that you have said that that just starts the inquiry. And once you start the inquiry in this case, Mr. Wright lost his lawyer, who was very experienced in these kinds of cases. He had been unable to work. He had been denied release so that he could work and assist his lawyer. So I think there was very real prejudice in this case on the speedy trial, and Judge Hogan should have dismissed it with prejudice. At this point, I will sit down and let Mr. Perline.
Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Good morning, members of the panel. Adam Kurland representing Linnell Glover. Members of the panel, all of the joint arguments, obviously, are equally applicable to Mr. Glover. I'm going to focus on issues 4 and 5, which relate solely to my client, Mr. Glover. The first one, with respect to issue 4, having to do with the government putting on the evidence of the other drug dealing other than the cocaine conspiracy. The government, in their brief, even captions, one of their captions is Glover's heroin and PCP trafficking. That's powerful stuff, and I think that's an accurate characterization as to the amount of the evidence. It wasn't merely other alleged drug dealing, drug conspiracy, drug selling. It was substantial evidence of other drug trafficking. There was no reason for this evidence to be admitted. And while the initial decisions with respect to this large case, which was cut up into a variety of
different... Why wasn't this intrinsic evidence related to the drug conspiracy?
Well, it's one of two things, Judge Silverman, that... Because if it was, then there was no legal basis. If it's intrinsic evidence to the conspiracy, then it's admissible as to all conspirators. That's just basic conspiracy law, no different than a statement made in furtherance of the conspiracy under the rules of evidence. But the government went out of its way, and the court went out of its way to say, no, it can't be admitted at all against Mr. Wright. So, which means that they can't have it both ways. If it were admitted as intrinsic evidence of the conspiracy, whatever that means, and I would suggest this court follow the Seventh Circuit and say that it's either part of a charged offense or it's not. Don't use that language because you're really getting into what's either 404B evidence or inadmissible propensity evidence. And that's exactly what happened here. Evidence of all this other prior drug dealing.
Let me ask you a question jumping ahead.
Sure.
Assuming we agree that the... assuming my arguendo that the drug was planted illegally in the truck, is there any PCP evidence left?
Is there any PCP? If all the truck bug evidence goes away, which I hope it does, is there, or it should under the law? What would be left over? Yes, there would still be some. That's an independent grounds for reversal. But if we parse it out that way, there is still independent evidence of PCP dealing based on some testimony, and heroin dealing, by the way, based on some testimony of Agent Bevington, and also some issues with regard to, I believe, some other information was found during the search. But if the statements are out, that would lead to reversal, and the court then could not have to address this issue. If the court, if the majority of the panel wants to do an opinion like that, that would be fine.
Judge Silverman wants to go ahead. I want to go back a little bit, which is to ask, what's the standard here? Is this a plain error review for us?
Well. hopefully I'll have time to get back to some of the substantive issues, but on that issue, Judge Brown, it is not plain error. Even under plain error, it's reversible because the error is plain on its face, and again, the prejudice is monumental, even under the plain error standard. It's not plain error because the purpose of the contemporaneous objection rule is that the trial judge have an opportunity to deal with the issue and make a full record. The judge, on four or five different occasions, clearly was going back and forth with respect to the limited purpose, and also on the record. I understand the government's position, and maybe the trial lawyer didn't do the most perfect job in articulating it, but in writing, he challenged this evidence as improper 404B evidence as being unfairly prejudicial. So it's been properly preserved. The contemporaneous objection principle is established here, and the record is clear. The record is clear on two other things, Judge Brown. Because the judge crammed it into this inextricably intertwined analysis, there was no 403 analysis undertaken. The government concedes that in their brief on page 69. And in addition, we need to understand with respect to what's going on here, the government created a straw man issue saying that this evidence is really not inextricably intertwined, or we only need to admit it for the purpose to prove that Mr. Glover had access to funds to fund his new cocaine venture. Well, $200,000 of money was found in his house. The government doesn't need to get into the most, under the law, the most highly inflammatory and highly unfairly prejudicial other acts evidence simply to establish an uncontroverted point.
Well, isn't the district judge entitled to wide discretion here?
The district judge, as any district judge, is entitled to the applicable standard of view with respect to these issues and abuse of discretion. But here, the mischaracterization of this inextricably intertwined, which, by the way, is wrong on its face because then it would have been admissible fully against Mr. Wright. And that's the last thing Mr. Wright wanted, and that's why Mr. Wright's lawyer, not Mr. Becker, but the trial lawyer, was able to pile on. So we got this double whammy. The evidence comes in improperly, it shouldn't come in at all, but improperly limited just to Mr. Glover. So that gives Mr. Wright, that gets into the other argument, Mr. Wright's counsel, the free rein to pound and pound and pound on, hey, look at all this evidence of Glover. He's guilty. He's surely going to get it. You'll get what's coming. But so it's legal error because it wasn't inextricably intertwined. So they mischaracterized it. And there was no balancing test that the court, and this perhaps goes directly to your point, the wide latitude that is normally given district judges that this panel, that this court gives the deference to, is based largely on the 403 balancing test, which did not happen here. This was outrageous. This evidence shouldn't have come in at all. Evidence, and it's just like those Seventh Circuit cases where the government puts on evidence of prior bank robberies to prove the guy has knowledge of the layout of the bank. They're trying to get the improper, unfairly prejudicial benefit of exposing the jury to all this other alleged drug dealing, and did not permit him to be able to focus in on the issue that and litigate and defend this case. Now, the other thing the government raises some sort of invited error arguments, but it's important to understand, and I filed a supplemental brief last night just on one issue, that Glover's trial lawyer had to deal with the lay of the land based on an improper decision, and simply at that point couldn't just throw up his hands and say, I'm not going to defend the case anymore. And so because of the improper decision where all this evidence comes in only against Glover, and every single time the evidence comes in, the judge goes out of its way to give that limiting instruction over and over and over again. And that's why there's that footnote about how it's like the Dostoevsky, you know, white bear thing. Tell the jury, you know, to tell the people to ignore a white bear, and then all of a sudden it's in your mind. I think about yourselves and everybody out there in the audience, they're going to be thinking about white bears now all day, even if you're told not to. And that's not new to me. I mean, the empirical evidence is out there that you tell somebody don't ignore it, or ignore it, soon you can't do it. So this was reemphasized seven times over. And none of it should have come in at all. So it's clearly wrong. The government doesn't need this to prove an uncontroverted issue as to did Mr. Glover have access to funds. Again, uncontroverted, bunch of money comes in, no need to put on this evidence of, again, in the government's own word, Glover's heroin and PCP trafficking. Let him be tried for that case. And it then gets funneled together because, and this gets into the fifth argument, Mr. Wright's counsel, and this isn't just a Zafiro situation, and I understand that Zafiro makes severance very, very, very difficult, super preference given to the district court's decision as to how to carve it up. But here we have the situation that even Justice Stevens in his concurrence in Zafiro pointed out, that the second prosecutor scenario, when amped up to the nth degree, creates a problem of the fair trial. And just like the government and the trial courts below carved up the case originally to get rid of or to try to resolve most of the fair trial concerns, they didn't do everything. And I know that Mr. Glover and anybody else, not entitled to a perfect trial, but entitled to a fair trial. But Mr. Wright's lawyers, taking advantage of this evidentiary ruling, essentially became not just a second prosecutor, because Mr. Glover's lawyers did stuff that, if the government did, sua sponte, the trial judge would have or had pressed the button and the marshals would have come and thrown him away. The government could not have done what Glover's counsel did. Wright's counsel, in closing argument, essentially wasn't just a second prosecutor, but was an avenger. He's going to get what's coming in that other case. You can be sure, wink, wink. And not even wink, wink. It was an outrageous comment. It's not up to me. I wasn't a trial lawyer. I have to deal with the record as to why there was not a contemporaneous objection made at the time. But it's sort of the inevitable snowball result of a bad evidentiary ruling that put Glover in a position of saying the only way I can now defend this case with all this other evidence coming in is to say that they proved this other conspiracy that I'm not charged with, not an intentional choice, but a choice forced on them given the record, and that also explains why, if the evidence is going to come in when it shouldn't at all, that's one explanation why Glover's counsel at trial sort of accedes to it, says, well, now I want the jury to know that there are these other pending charges because I'm in this lose-lose proposition and I have to make the best of a horrible illegal situation based on these wrong rulings. And so in the end, you end up with situations where the issues are properly preserved, sufficiently preserved for regular harmless error review, which is established. There should raise a doubt in everybody's mind that the consideration of the evidence would have been different. And two, even under plain error, this is extreme. And again, I know this court is loath is probably the wrong word, hardly ever reverses on a Zafiro severance issue. But again, Justice Stevens, you know, pointed out that, and I know it was a concurrence, and one justice concurrence at that, but this dual prosecutor issue on steroids is the situation we have here.
Thank you, Mr. Kerman.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. John Pigadez on behalf of the United States. I'll turn my attention first to the issue of the truck bug. In our brief, we began our argument on page 40 by pointing out that the plain language of the statute authorized what occurred here. And the plain language of the statute...
What about Rule 41?
Well, I think when you've, Judge Silverman, you've got a plain language statute here, which I think would trump Rule 41 in this case. You've got the statute which...
Are you suggesting that Rule 41 is not legal?
No, not at all, Your Honor. But I want to focus on the plain language of the statute here, which permits a court to issue an order authorizing the installation of a device outside its territorial jurisdiction where the device is a mobile interception device.
So and are you conceding that Rule 41 was violated?
No, I'm not conceding that, Your Honor.
Well, then why don't you focus on that for a moment? Was it violated or not?
No, it was not violated. This search, this was an authorized, legal, valid search here.
What do you say 3117 authorizes?
No, I'm talking about 2518, Section 3. 3117 isn't at play in this case.
Okay.
The statute specifically authorizes a judge, in this case in the District of Columbia, to authorize an order for the installation of a mobile interception device, which includes a device, a listening device installed in a vehicle within its jurisdiction or outside that jurisdiction in the case of a mobile interception device. And implicit with that, and it was specifically authorized in Judge Collier's order in this case, was to use covert or to authorize the covert or surreptitious entry to install that device in the truck, which was at the time located at the BWI airport.
Are you focusing on Rule 41?
Well, I'm focusing on what happened here, Your Honor.
I know. Why don't you look at Rule 41? Counsel for the other side points out that you seem to ignore Rule 41 in the brief. I think I can understand why.
I think in our brief we focused on what was clearly authorized under the statute.
So, in other words, are you conceding that it was in violation of Rule 41?
No, we're not conceding a violation of Rule 41 because this was not a violation of a Fourth Amendment search and seizure. There was no Fourth Amendment search and seizure violation issue here.
Why is that?
Because there was a valid warrant for the FBI agents to enter the vehicle and install the listening device.
What is the relevant language in Rule 41? I'm looking for it right now.
Are you referring to 41B, the authority to issue a warrant?
As I read it, it made it clear that the district judge would have to authorize the warrant in the jurisdiction in which the district judge sat. In other words, the wiretap would have to be in the jurisdiction in which the judge sat. Isn't that correct?
I don't believe that's correct in the case of a mobile interception device under the statute, 2518, Section 3, which refers to the installation of mobile interception devices. And if you look at the very particular language of the statute, and it really kind of makes sense.
Forgive me. You would concede if this was in violation of Rule 41, then it falls under the statutory provision of double I. The order or authorization or approval under which it was intercepted is insufficient on its face. Is that correct? If it was in violation.
If it was in violation, that would be the analytical vehicle, but there was no violation.
You wouldn't look at a single lie. The communication was unlawfully intercepted. You would look at double lie. That's correct.
I believe that's correct.
So that's the issue. That's the toughest issue in the case.
I believe that's the analytical vehicle, but I don't.
You don't agree that it was a violation of Rule 41?
I don't agree that there was a violation. And
you didn't make clear in your brief why you didn't think it was a violation of Rule 41.
Well, I think we started out our argument with the premise that this was clearly authorized under Section 2518, Section 3, for the judge to issue an order for the installation outside that jurisdiction where this was a mobile interception device. And I think that's pretty clear from the language of the statute. Otherwise, there really wouldn't seem to be a point for Congress to include that language in there. And I think that's what Congress meant. If you look at the legislative history. So clearly the statute authorizes exactly what happened here, and there's many good reasons why that reading makes sense for the statute to contemplate in this kind of a situation installation outside the jurisdiction. I would note that it did extensive research on this and found absolutely no litigation cases discussing this one way or the other, which suggests the plain reading of the interpretation that we've advocated here. And it's, I think, really by sheer chance that at the time that the FBI apply for this particular mobile interception device, that the car was in Maryland, where there was an opportunity to surreptitiously and safely enter the car to install the listening device. And the chance location of the truck had really no relation to the location of appellant's crimes in this case, or of the government's investigation of those crimes. And the
I can understand the argument where you're in a geographic location where people are crossing jurisdictional boundaries all the time, like the D.C. metropolitan area. But wouldn't that mean that this Judge Collier then could have authorized this for his vehicle if it was in Florida, let's say?
I think that's correct. But she didn't. She limited it very carefully to the parameters of this investigation. I think it's important to...
She could have authorized the insertion of this bug anywhere in the United States?
Yes, I believe that's what's in the statute, as long as it's in the United States. She couldn't do it outside the United States, but the statute provides that it's within the United States. So she was very careful about it. And if you think about it, it makes sense. Judge Collier was already supervising a number of wiretaps on cell phones and perhaps even landline phones, and this had been going on for some time. So it made sense for one judge in this case to continue to assume supervisory authority over those wire interceptions in this case. And I think it just not only makes sense, but it was specifically authorized by the plain language of the statute. If the court has no further questions on that point, I would like to move on to Professor Curlin's points regarding the other crimes evidence. And I really would like to begin by pointing out that I think not only, I think at best his claim should be reviewed for plain error, but there is really an argument here, as we set forth in our brief, that it's been waived. The government filed, and I just want to review the history of this a little bit so the court has the clear context of it. The government filed a motion on June 10th of 2009 arguing that the evidence of these conversations indicated that Glover intended to use the profits from his heroin and PC distribution scheme to fund a cocaine deal. And attached to that pleading, and the government argued two theories, one that it was intrinsic to the conspiracy, and number two that it was admissible under Rule 404B as evidence of the cocaine conspiracy of intent, knowledge, and plan. And that's at 26 of our supplemental appendix. Mr. Glover filed a response to that, which is at appendix 383 and 384, the relevant portions, indicating that he had no objection to the admission of these recorded conversations, provided that the government could produce evidence regarding the interpretation of the conversations and that the government timely identified the conversations upon which it relied. The government did that in this case. The only objection that Mr. Glover made was to the extent that the government intends to introduce under Rule 404B evidence that is not intrinsic to the conspiracy. There was a hearing on June 25th of 2009, at which point there was, as Mr. Curlin points out, a lot of back and forth. But the back and forth wasn't about the admissibility of any of this evidence. The back and forth really was about under what theory would it come in, as intrinsic to the conspiracy or as Rule 404B evidence. And the judge admitted it as intrinsic to the conspiracy, but indicated that it would give a very carefully crafted instruction with the assistance of the parties to indicate to the jury just how it was that this evidence was coming in, to be very careful about it. Now, just because the judge subsequently pointed out that the instruction or that the evidence had nothing to do with Wright in terms of Wright's participation in PCP and heroin trafficking. And by the way, I would just like to mention as an aside that the caption of the government's heading of that section in our brief really doesn't define what the issue was here. There wasn't really any evidence of trafficking. It was these conversations primarily. And then later made it clear exactly how this evidence should be regarded by the jury. There was another hearing on January 6th of 2010, right before the trial, in which there was some further discussion about this evidence, and I think it came up in terms of Wright's attorney, who had recently entered an appearance in this case, Judge Hovell ruled that that she had ruled that the evidence was admissible. She had noted that Glover had not objected to that, and indeed Glover acquiesced at the time and said nothing. So this evidence came in. I've combed the record. I can't find any place in the record during the course of the trial or in the proceedings that I've just outlined in which Mr. Glover registered a specific objection to any of this coming in at all. And so that is why this should be reviewed at best for plain error, and arguably it was waived. In any event, under any standard of review, Judge Hovell did not abuse her ample discretion in admitting this evidence. This evidence was intrinsic to, inextricably intertwined with Mr. Glover and Mr. Wright's and Mr. Robbins' plans to acquire cocaine using money from the PCP and heroin business, and indeed to get out of the PCP and heroin business because the cocaine business was going to be much more lucrative. And I believe that that came out through the course of all of these, actually all of them. I say there was only four or five truck bug discussions in which there was discussion about this PCP and heroin information and how.
Do you really want to rest on inextricably intertwined? We have questioned that as being kind of a nonsense notion.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the full question.
Do you really want to rest on inextricably intertwined? We have already doubted the validity of that notion in Bowie.
I think
and in this case, it seems kind of a strange notion as well. I mean, that's the best. Is that the best that you have?
No, it's not the best that I have. I think.
Well, why don't you start with the best that you have?
I think it's pretty good. Yeah. But
well, we have.
But I also have another.
We have said it's not pretty good.
I think it backed away in terms of completing the story. I think that's what in the Bowie case, retreating from these other formulations of how the evidence is. But it's also part and parcel of this conspiracy. I think Judge Hovell used those words as part and parcel of the conspiracy. And to that extent, it was also admissible under Rule 404B, although Judge Hovell did not rest on that. It certainly was admissible. We've made that alternative argument in our brief because it's evidence of the planning. It's evidence of the intent that was to go on here to acquire this cocaine and to use the proceeds from the PCP and heroin business to get out of that and to propel the conspiracy to acquire this cocaine forward by using those funds. So not only was it intrinsic, but it was also 404B. It was part and parcel of the plan here. And so those are the two pitches that I'm tossing out here.
Counsel, forgive me for going back to the issue that bothers me. I was just sort of puzzled at how you were dealing with Rule 41. Doesn't it specifically say a magistrate's judge with authority in the district has authority to issue a warrant to search for and seize a person or property located within the district?
That's correct.
Why wasn't this clearly in violation of Rule 41?
We have a statute here that Congress also promulgated.
Yes, and the statute doesn't explicitly deal with this. Rule 41 does.
I think the statute does.
I'm not sure what that parenthetical. I really have to go back and look at the cases in 2518. The parenthetical, which is what you're relying on.
Correct.
Outside that jurisdiction, but within the United States, in the case of a mobile interception device authorized by a federal court within such jurisdiction. That sounds like it has to be by someone else. Now, I frankly am thrown by this. I'll have to go back and research that. You are throwing it out very cavalierly as if 2518 is clear. It is not clear. And that's what's bothering Judge Silverman. 41 seems to be quite clear. 2518, which you're resting on hard, is not. Is there any circuit that is interpreted the way you've said? And the problem all three of us would likely have is you're saying anywhere in the United States. Well, that's not what I read this parenthetical to say. device authorized by a federal court within such jurisdiction.
If you in which the judge is sitting
it, and... Point us to authority that supports your proposition that 2518 authorizes someone in this jurisdiction to do what you're claiming anywhere in the United States. I don't read 2518 on its face to say that. It's at least ambiguous, but it certainly doesn't say it clearly. You're talking as if it's just absolutely clear.
And I think you're also making the argument, essentially, that somehow Rule 41 is illegal.
No, I'm not making that argument
well,
at all.
Is it not crystal clear that 41, B, 1, and 2, 2 does allow the property outside the district if it was located within the district when the warrant is issued? I don't understand. I mean, you don't need any authority. That language was explicitly violated.
And not inconsistent with 2518 the way I'm reading it.
Right, that's absolutely correct. 2518 is at best, as Judge Edwards points out, ambiguous, but 41B is crystal clear, isn't it?
I agree the language is crystal clear.
So what? So we should throw it out?
No. My argument is that the language in 2518.3, and I know Judge Edwards disagrees and wants to look at some authority on this. I read the parenthetical.
I think what you're saying is the statute is inconsistent with the rule. That's your argument.
I'd like to see some authority that says that, though.
Yes, that is not an argument you made in your brief at all. And it's, in fact, an extraordinary argument because it would mean that when the rule was adopted by the Supreme Court, it was in violation of the statute.
Well, I have not, Judge Edwards, as I indicated before in my argument, I've not been able to find any authority in any jurisdiction.
That could
to
be because it's blatantly in violation of the rule.
Yeah, just look. You forced me to look really hard because I was stunned at your argument. I'm like, where is this coming from? And now I'm looking at the language, and I understand why I was stunned. That made me feel a little bit better, because the language just doesn't support what you're arguing.
No,
and if there's authority, that's fine. I'm bound by precedent, but I haven't found it, and you're saying you don't know of any either.
The only authority that I know of that I found was to look at the legislative history interpreting...
Oh, you don't want to go there, do you?
I've never wanted to go there. So that's one of our arguments. I mean, we've set forth arguments in our brief as to why...
I don't understand why you didn't confess error on this one.
Well, we didn't see a basis to confess error in this case. And I know I'm well out of time, but we have made some arguments in our brief as to why... that this was implicitly authorized under the Supreme Court's decision in Dahlia, but I'd also like to make some arguments that this was not a basis for suppression in any case, and I would point to the Giordano and Chavez cases as well as Moore.
You mean on the core concept, that's the argument you made in the brief. The problem with that is it goes to the statutory provision. Single I, not double I.
Well, the core concerns under Title III are protecting the privacy of communications, as well as delaying a uniform basis upon which the circumstances and conditions under which the interception of communications may be authorized. So this doesn't go to the core concerns of the statute, number one. Number two, there's a good faith liaison.
You don't have to under double I if it was insufficient on its face.
Well, there's a good faith Leon basis as well that the officers were...
How can there be good faith in this case when the warrant is insufficient on its face?
Well, the FBI agents acted under the belief that the warrant was sufficient on its face.
Because they can't read English.
Well, I think they had a... I wouldn't say that.
Also the U.S. Assistant U.S. Attorney.
Believe the interpretation of the statute that I've advocated here today. But I would also like, I think there was a question earlier, and this assumes that this court would find that there was error, and then the court has to make an assessment of what to do with that. There's two things I would like to point out. Number one, this really, and I think we've laid this out in our brief, wasn't really teed up before Judge Hogan or before Judge Huvel on this quote-unquote territorial jurisdiction of the truck bug. There were a lot of issues that were teed up before Judge Hogan and Judge Huvel surrounding the wiretap interception in this case.
I read the transcript, and although the counsel, defense counsel, did refer to the GPS Jones issue, he also referred to the territorial jurisdiction issue.
That was in the early on in the.
It's true, and Judge Huvel said that all the decisions Judge Hogan made were to be continued on.
But Judge Hogan didn't make a decision on this. Judge Hogan's decision assumed the validity of the warrant. He didn't.
Well, that doesn't help.
Well, it doesn't help determine exactly what the court was thinking, except that it helps determine that the court wasn't focused on an issue about territorial jurisdiction.
I don't have any doubt. Judge Hogan's an excellent judge. If he was focused on this issue, I don't think there'd have been any doubt that he would have resolved it.
We won't know because there just simply wasn't a decision, and I think appellants have an obligation to.
It was argued before Judge Hogan, and it's argued here, and the plain language of the rule was violated.
There's one more point I would like to make, and I think this. I'm not avoiding you, Judge Silverman.
No, I understand.
But I do want to. I do want to get my arguments out. There was a question that came up to one of the opposing counsel as to what evidence there was as a result of this truck bug that harmed the client. I think it was a question that was posed to Mr. Becker. And there was quite a bit more evidence in this case inculpating both appellants than was developed through the truck bug evidence. There were essentially
Are you saying if we concluded that the warrant was improperly issued, that the case would not have to be reversed and remanded?
That's correct. I'm concluding that if you disagreed with the government and found that the warrant was...
All that evidence that came out of the truck bug would have to be excluded and you'd still have enough to convict?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There was... by my count, maybe a dozen or more conversations, telephone conversations, under the unchallenged wiretap of Mr. Glover's phone and other telephones.
Well, I thought the whole problem with the truck bug was that you couldn't get enough from the normal wiretaps. You didn't have enough.
So well, the
you
problem
yourself,
I...
you yourself had indicated that when you asked for the truck bug.
Part of the problem was that they were getting evidence, but it wasn't enough because at times... And I think this was set forth in the application and the affidavit that Mr. Glover would retreat into his truck where he could have
private conversations.
What he believed to be private conversations. However, there continued to be evidence that was introduced at trial from the telephone conversations as well as the surveillance, as well as records pertaining to the flight records to the Bahamas, as well as the evidence from cooperating witness Diane Holmes, as well as the evidence of the rental car records from Mr. Wright and Ms. Holmes. In short, there was an abundance of evidence independent of the four or five truck bug conversations. And if you throw out the four or five truck bug conversations, there's overwhelming evidence left in this case that would not require a reversal of appellant's convictions.
Thank you, counsel. Okay. I don't think anyone had any time left, right?
No.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge Brown.
1 minute?
Yes, I will be very quick. Robert Becker again for the purpose of the record. Just want to make 2 points. I think I can resolve your question about the interaction of Rule 41 with the statute. The statute talks about intercepting communications. Rule 41 deals with installation of the device. And if you look at it that way, then the two reconcile. The only way 2518.3 can be read as permitting the installation of the device is if you accept Dahlia as controlling. And after Jones, I don't think you can find Dahlia controlling. As to the last question I believe you asked, Judge Silverman, about what happens if the truck bug goes away, the government at this case, if it was a Fourth Amendment violation, then the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that evidence didn't affect the outcome. If it is viewed as a violation of 2518 of Title III, then we're dealing with, there's no reasonable possibility that the evidence affected the verdict. So the fact that the government had other evidence that might have won a conviction is not the question here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Again, Adam Perlin for Mr. Glover. I'll be, again, very brief. The government's argument with respect to the inextricably intertwined, it's doublespeak on its own. Even when they talked about it in 404B, they said it's part and parcel of this conspiracy. The bottom line is, if it was inextricably intertwined and part and parcel of the conspiracy, it would have been admitted against every co-defendant, including Mr. Wright. The government knew that they couldn't deal with that, so they went. That's why they went along with the arguments that the court had with respect to how to fashion this extraordinary limiting to make sure it was only usable. That proves that it wasn't inextricably intertwined with the conspiracy. That's like a co-conspirator statement coming in, and the government arguing, "Oh, we only wanted it against Mr. A, B, and C, not the other co-defendants." They never do that, and the government in this case could have never established that the statements were in furtherance of the conspiracy. There was never the 403 balancing test that was undertaken. The evidence shouldn't have come in, and the court should take the next step beyond simply just the concerns it's expressed before and say inextricably intertwined. It's either part of the conspiracy, we're not going to use that language anymore, because we'll look at it under 404B and the unfair prejudice. They didn't need it to prove this access to the money. If that really was part of the conspiracy, the way that Mr. Cadiz argued it here, it should have come in against everybody. That isn't the case. It was unfairly prejudicial against Mr. Glover.
There's very little evidence of the PCB outside of the truck bug.
There's some, but again, this was a cocaine conspiracy case, and they reindicted this case separately because they knew this was they went through the whole grand jury rigmarole. This was a separate cocaine conspiracy, and it was improper, it was inflammatory, it was unfairly prejudicial. The government misused it, and Mr. Wright's counsel, again, trying to piggyback on with respect to that defense. The one other thing I just want to say is that with respect to there's no need for Mr. Glover to continue to object. The government pointed out on page 384 and 385 of the appendix, I won't read the language, but it's clear that the issue with respect to, they're not clear if it's 404B, they're not clear if it's inextricably intertwined, they're not clear as to exactly how the government's going to argue it. The issue was properly raised at the trial level, and the fact that they point out, well, he was silent 88 pages later or 4 days later, we cite in our brief the very clear, uncontroverted law in the federal courts that you do not have to continually object when it's futile. When the judge made the ruling, the judge said it was clearly admissible as inextricably intertwined evidence. Glover's counsel has to just, you know, fight his battles when they can. No obligation under the law to keep on raising it. And one last thing, I'd be remiss without saying that if the evidence of the truck bug is out, I think reversal is based on these other grounds as well, but if the evidence of the truck bug is out, at minimum, there's a new trial, and then it goes back to the trial court for the determination as to whether or not, if the evidence is unconstitutionally excluded, on a constitutional grounds, whether or not double jeopardy bars retrial for insufficient evidence. That's a separate issue the court doesn't have to get.
Mr. Curlin.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Becker, Mr. Curlin, I know you were both appointed by the court to represent these appellants in these cases, and the court thanks you very much for your assistance.
You're very welcome.